afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Sonia Hilgren, and I am chairwoman of the Board of Governors of the National Press Club and Washington editor of Farm Journal. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming events. Tomorrow, Lady Margaret Thatcher will discuss current affairs and her days as the British Prime Minister. This luncheon is sold out. On Tuesday, November 9th, Gilbert Grosvenor, president of the National Geographic Society, will present a speech entitled, "Clean Water, Will There Be Enough Tomorrow?" And on Wednesday, November 10th, Sheldon Hackney, chairman of the National Endowment for the Humanities, will present a speech entitled Beyond the Culture Wars. Other upcoming luncheon speakers include Indiana University basketball coach Bobby Knight, the Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Rabin, Barney and his creator, Cheryl Leach, violence against women expert Catherine McKinnon, President of Harrah's Casinos, Paul Satre, U.S. Surgeon General Jocelyn Elders, FBI Director Louis Free, and TV producer Norman Lear. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table and pass them up to me. I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Ted Gupp, freelance journalist, Andrea Shalel Essa, Reuters, David Briscoe, Associated Press, Diana McMeekin, Executive Vice President, African Wildlife Foundation, Hillary McKenzie, Canadian journalist, John Hemingway, Chairman, African Wildlife Foundation, Christy Wise, freelance journalist and vice chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, Paul T. Schindler, president, African Wildlife Foundation, Sandra McElwain, freelance journalist, Keith Epstein, Cleveland Plain Dealer, Mary Smith, National Geographic, and Mary Hager, Newsweek. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Thornsberry, Melanie Abdo-Dermont, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Dr. Ian Douglas Hamilton, Senior Associate for the African Wildlife Foundation, is one of the world's foremost authorities on the African elephant. His crusade to save the elephant began more than two decades ago when he came across disturbing signs of organized poaching in Kenya, where he lived with his wife, Oria, a fellow conservationist. Repelled first by the carnage and then by the data that revealed the elephant population had been cut in half, they set out to disclose the extent of the slaughter sweeping through the continent. Their campaign, Only Elephants Should Wear Ivory, was instrumental in launching the 1989 International Ivory Ban, and their books, Among the Elephants and Battle for the Elephants, alerted the world to the horrors of poaching. A Scottish zoologist, Dr. Douglas Hamilton first became fascinated with Africa as a boy. After graduating from Oxford, he set up camp at a game preserve in Tanzania in order to study the habits of the seven-ton creatures. His interest evolved into an obsession, and in his quest to save the species, he has been crushed by a rhinoceros. It gets worse, shot at by poachers, and nearly killed in a plane crash. His activism led to the stewardship of the African Elephant Program for the European Economic Community, and for his work, he was recently awarded the Order of British Empire by Queen Elizabeth. Currently, Dr. Douglas Hamilton and his wife are producing films about African wildlife from their home in Kenya. Last month, ESPN ran a special Island of the Elephants in which he takes the viewer to Amboseli National Park to watch Africa's majestic elephants in their natural habitat. Please welcome to the National Press Club, Dr. Ian Douglas Hamilton.
It is indeed a very great honor to be speaking here at the National Press Club. I'm most grateful to Sonia Hilgren for her kind remarks. I'm equally honored by the African Wildlife Foundation, represented here by Diana McMeekin, Paul Schindler, and John Hemingway, for allowing me to speak on their behalf as a senior associate. You can't imagine how I feel to think that Maggie Thatcher is speaking tomorrow, distinguished as being the first leader in the Western world to ban the ivory trade. For many years, I've admired the commitment of the African Wildlife Foundation's field officers in remote parts of Africa, saving critically endangered species such as gorillas, rhinos, and now elephants. These biologists and educators are ably supported from their Nairobi office, led by Mark Stanley Price, who works in partnership with local peoples and governments. It's an excellent center for field people to meet and exchange news about the bush. I've been working with elephants for about 28 years and for two decades witnessed a catastrophic decline, principally due to the ivory trade. Although the devastating elephant declines of the 1970s and 1980s have now been checked by the ivory trade ban of 1989, it has not totally gone away. Ivory is still moving. Only last week, on Tuesday, the South African Endangered Wildlife Protection Unit uncovered a ring of Taiwanese smugglers with a hoard of 900 pieces of ivory, probably representing the remains of 500 individual elephants. It was cut into small pieces disguised by a coat of black paint, and due to be shipped to Taiwan, probably destined to be smuggled from there into Japan. 2 days later, five Koreans were apprehended in Kenya, who were charged with illegal possession of more than half a ton of ivory, and investigations are underway to see if there was an ivory processing factory. This ivory had laid buried since the ban and is thought to have come from Tanzania and Somalia. The ivory consumer market may be dead in the West, but it is still alive in the East. Ivory is openly on sale in the shops in Korea, South Korea, a nation which has only just joined the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. Ivory is still moving in Africa, but more as a cottage industry rather than the large consignments of 20 tons of former years. With many areas suffering from wars or civil disturbances, controls are often non-existent. Somalia is reported to have a huge stockpile. Burundi has over 80 tons, said to be under lock and key a month ago. But what will happen to it now? The ban on ivory is fragile, and the ceasefire gained for elephants would be reversed if the ivory trade ever opened up to regain its previous levels. We cannot afford to be complacent about the ban. Africa is still a turbulent continent. Ivory poachers were not poor people who had their crops destroyed by elephants. More often, they were quasi-military bands motivated by money rather than defending crops. Why should one care about elephants? I believe the answers are ethical and economic and relate to whether or not we can preserve enough space on this earth for elephants and ultimately for ourselves in the light of exponential human increase. A healthy elephant population means a healthy environment. Wildlife-based tourism, including elephant watching, can provide a huge source of income for the people of Africa. In Kenya, there were 698,000 visitors last year, and the elephant viewing component alone has been estimated worth $20 million. trend in Africa now is to share wildlife revenues with local people who in turn share the land with the wildlife. And in Kenya, 25% of park gate revenues go to the people. My own experience of elephants began in 1965 when I entered their world as a privileged visitor to study 450 overcrowded elephants in the Lake Manyara National Park in Tanzania. I arrived fresh from Oxford with ears and eyes untrained for the bush. My experience was zero, but my adrenaline was at 100%. And when I first ventured into the forest, my reaction when I met the elephants was flight. They were led by formidable matriarchs who in those days used to charge my car, stopping only feet away, kicking up dust, sometimes hurling objects, usually shaking their head and trumpeting and growling thunderously. But I soon learned that my fear was matched by theirs, and that 95% of the charges were bluff. That in fact, these female leaders were facing something that they feared and dreaded, probably as a result of some traumatic experience of man in the past. It was then I realized that elephants share some of the qualities of altruism and self-sacrifice that we most admire in our own species, because the matriarch would come out and bravely cover her family's escape. Of course, not all of the charges were bluff, and on one occasion, my car was transfixed by the tusks of a rather large matriarch who jammed them into the radiator while another tried to crush the cab of my pickup with her head. Her eye glared at me through the open window and I could almost touch it with my hand. And when I saw the film Jurassic Park the other day, I really felt I'd already been there. But it was in their relations to each other that the elephants appeared to possess an intelligence and sensitivity and a strong expression of emotion and attachment. Major discoveries have been made in the long-term field studies of American scientists, Cynthia Moss and Joyce Poole, Katie Payne and Willem Langbauer, who've described an animal with a strong social system, unusual means of communication, and many features akin to our own species, such as long life, teaching of the young during a prolonged childhood, and an age of childbearing, all measuring roughly the same as our own. They also seem to have a sense of death in the way they are fascinated by carcasses of their own species. And as sensate fellow beings, I would put to you that they deserve an ethical treatment at our hands. My studies of elephant behavior ended when the price of ivory rose in the early 1970s. We now know with hindsight that the price rise was fueled by the rising economic power of Japan and the ability of ordinary Japanese to buy name seals called hankos made out of ivory with which to sign their letters. The effects on the ground were catastrophic. In 1975, in collaboration with scientific colleagues, I began a pan-African elephant study, and beginning with East Africa, was able to document waves of poaching which decimated the populations of famous national parks. My aerial surveys showed that in the Murchison Falls Park in Uganda, elephants went from 14,000 to down to 2,000. In Tsavo in Kenya, they fell from 50,000 down to 7,500. And in the Selous Game Reserve in Tanzania, the largest population ever censused, from over 100,000 to 55,000. Together with my colleagues, I assembled a picture for the continent. This work was only made possible by my generous donors, including National Geographic, the African Wildlife Foundation, World Wildlife Foundation, and New York Zoological Society, the Wildlife Conservation Society, and the European Community. The equatorial forest, however, was beyond the reach of my surveys and still presented a mystery, containing one-third of the elephant's range and perhaps more than half the elephants. It was not until Dr. Richard Barnes solved the problem of how to estimate elephants by counting their droppings, that the first field-based numbers were available. He confirmed that the situation in the forest from the late 70s and throughout the 80s was as bad as in East Africa. Only in parts of southern Africa were elephants stable or increasing, but this was a minority of the continental population. By 1987, scientists of the African Elephant Specialist Group accepted that the ivory trade was unsustainable. It was believed that the minimum of 1.3 million elephants in Africa in 1979 had dropped to approximately 609,000 by 1989. The drop in elephant numbers was matched in the ivory offtakes calculated for the decade by TRAFIC, the group that monitors trade in endangered species, when ivory equivalent to some 700,000 elephants was exported from Africa. Now, elephant numbers and trends have been disputed, and these figures are not absolute. They may yet be revised with the benefit of hindsight and new methods of analysis, but the overall picture is clear. There was a massive and unprecedented decline of elephants, one of the most wasteful mammalian tragedies of the century. What I saw in my surveys was ever more carcasses. What TRAFIC recorded was an increase in ivory exports, followed by a crash, even though the price continued up. And when you looked at the living elephants, the age structures were completely skewed through a lack of older animals that had been killed for their ivory. An American field biologist working in some of the areas that I wasn't able to visit, Michael Fay, has described the ivory fever which gripped people living in the central African forests in northern Congo, who were supplied with guns and ammunition by middlemen and encouraged to abandon their agriculture and go out into the forest to kill elephants to come back with the ivory. These facts and the press coverage of the slaughter of the elephants on television increased the momentum to control the ivory trade. NGOs of all stripes lobbied for a ban on the ivory trade. African Wildlife Foundation played a lead role when they declared the Year of the Elephant in 1988 and launched a public awareness campaign with the slogan, "Only elephants should wear ivory." The ivory trade ban, introduced by the CITES parties in 1989, has been a success, although it is not the whole solution. As I've already mentioned, ivory is moving again in small packets in Kenya, Somalia, and South Africa. There's also an immense potential danger, I see, in the predicted emergence of China as an economic superpower. Ordinary Chinese have not been able to afford ivory up to now, but it is part of their culture to value it. With increased buying power, the price of ivory could be propelled upwards, just as it was before in the early 70s, when ordinary Japanese were able to buy it at any price. There is also a gross underfunding of the national parks and reserves set aside for elephants, exacerbated by Africa's chronic problem of debt-stricken economies. It is a sad reflection that one of the consequences of the International Monetary Fund's austerity rules for Zimbabwe has been the axing of all funds for anti-poaching by the Zimbabwe government. Despite an admirable record in the past, the Zimbabwe Wildlife Department is now unable to stop the rhino and elephant poaching for lack of funds. There's also the serious question of human population increase. Africa's population now stands at about 548 million people, and optimistically 550 to 650,000 elephants. If demographers are right, there may be 2.9 billion people by the year 2050. What will be left for the elephants, and under what conditions? 29 out of 36 of the world's poorest countries are in Africa, and 325 million people are living in conditions of absolute poverty. These people living at a great density cannot be blamed in places for stripping the land of its resources, woodland pastures and soils, as they have no choice when trying to survive. All they can do as environmental refugees is to move, but where can they go? If they go into the cities, it's probably going to further destabilize countries. Can they migrate to the north, to our rich countries? I very much doubt they would be accepted. But, of course, some of them can go into the national parks and reserves, which preserve the last pristine natural habitats. We must address these problems. What can we do to save the elephants? Firstly, the ban should stay in place and give the population a chance to recover. The CITES ivory trade ban comes up for review at the next meeting of the CITES parties in exactly 1 year's time, when they meet in America. There may be cause for limited ivory trading to be resumed, but these would send out a signal to all the ivory traders and poachers currently out of business that the trade was on again, and it would be impossible to prevent illegal ivory from mixing with legal stocks in Africa as it is today. The ivory ban, however, will not work on its own, and as I said, there's a desperate need for funding. In this connection, a little-known but highly significant fund has been developed by the US Fish and Wildlife Services under the African Elephant Conservation Act, a non-partisan bill sponsored by Congressman Jack Fields and Anthony Beilinson. It started dispensing $350,000 in 1990 and has continued and will be worth $1.2 million in the current year. This fund has already supported 32 projects, including 12 countries within the African elephant's range. These vary from emergency assistance to inoculate the rare desert elephants of the Namibia, from anthrax to development of the conservation of a forest glade deep in the equatorial forest in Central Africa at a place called Bayanga, one of the few places where the shy forest elephants can actually be seen. This project could lead to a number of sister projects that would end up protecting a huge chunk of unspoiled tropical rainforest. A brand new project in Zimbabwe has been to move complete family units of elephants instead of culling them. There's a huge demand in parts of southern Africa on private land for restocking elephants in their former range. And now that the new technology has been developed with this grant, it will in some cases provide an alternative to culling overpopulated elephants. The cost is also cheaper than anticipated, and the government is charging a fee can recoup expenses instead of paying for the expense of culling. A total of 900 elephants have been moved so far from Gonarezhou National Park to private land in Zimbabwe, Botswana and South Africa. We never thought this solution was possible before for controlling elephant numbers. I can say that this fund of the US Fish and Wildlife Service, working with NGOs and governments, has been highly effective, and I recommend that it be renewed and increased in the future. The fund has also enabled elephant scientists and managers to meet in the different regions of Africa to hammer out realistic conservation plans. One of the most significant catalytic projects was support for a conference held in Nairobi, where almost all the elephant range states met with donor countries to discuss the elephant's future. The African Wildlife Foundation played a key role in coordinating this vast undertaking of drawing up elephant action plans for each state in the elephant's range across the country. In most cases, this meant setting up programs for the very most basic wildlife management to protect the elephant ecosystems, and in total, the bill amounted to some $350 million. Little of this, of course, will ever be met. But conserving elephants in a healthy way means conserving healthy ecosystems and the basic life support processes of nature. It is a challenge to donor nations to attach environmental impact assessments on every budget proposal for development aid in Africa before destroying more forests and natural ecosystems, and to act on these reports, not to ignore them. Another necessity is to put pressure on those countries that do not abide by CITES rules. 3 days from now, President Clinton must decide on whether or not to impose trade sanctions on the People's Republic of China and Taiwan for violations of an international treaty imposing a moratorium in trade in endangered rhinoceros, tigers, and the products of other endangered species. I would urge President Clinton to use his influence to pressure these countries into acting more responsibly. If this can only be done by sanctions, so be it. And you in the press can help by communicating to the public the threats to the world's natural resources, including endangered species, and possible solutions. I'm heartened by my latest surveys in Kenya, where I no longer see dead elephants beyond the level expected by natural mortality. The formidable Somali gunmen have been confronted and defeated in the field, and the low ivory price gives them no incentive to return. Finally, using a metaphor that appeared in Douglas Chadwick's excellent book, The Fate of Elephants, I would liken an elephant to a seven-ton canary. Canaries were used by miners to tell them when their environment was critically dangerous. If the canary died, they were in danger. If elephants die, ultimately it is we who are in danger. Healthy elephants mean a healthy environment and some margin left for us.
You did issue a call for press coverage, but in general, has press coverage in the recent past of wildlife interests been more sophisticated? Is it more attentive only because of controversies?
I think that press coverage goes very much with the swing of the times. Elephants were a great fashionable item in 1989, and there was a great deal of interest in the public and therefore a lot of press coverage. Since then, the interest has rather died away, and a lot of people seem to think that all the elephant problems are solved.
That question was just a warm-up. I want to ask you about Ray Bonner, who actually spoke here earlier this year. He has written a book about Africans, about the ivory trade. Would you like to respond?
Well, what is the question about the book?
Well, I understand that you don't like the book, and I thought maybe you'd like to tell us about that.
I have to confess that I have not read the book from cover to cover. I've read the rude bits he wrote about me, but I found that in detail he was inaccurate, and what I thought was a pity that the book was so slanted when somebody had such access to give a balanced coverage, and it was a pity that he only chose things that he that suited his case to criticize and not to look at the overall situation. The organizations that he criticized, on balance, have done far more good than anything wrong they might ever have done. So that was the major thing about his book, I thought.
Do you think that his book would harm your efforts to maintain interest in banning ivory?
Not really, because his facts weren't that good. He didn't really... I mean, I read the article that appeared in the New York Times, and it was prefaced, "Crying wolf over elephants." Well, I mean, nobody can accept that people were crying wolf. We've got the sound scientific data that prove that the elephant halved in numbers over 10 years. Another item he said was that people had switched their position on the ban in the trade of ivory, and I didn't think that was true either. Nobody was keen to stop the ivory trade in the southern African countries to begin with. And so the measures against the trade were slowly ratcheted upwards with increasing severity. But every time a new control came in, it was evaded by the ivory traders. And in the end, it was quite plain that nothing short of a total ban was going to have any effect whatsoever.
What effect has the end of the Cold War and the resulting decline in interest and aid to Africa and developing countries had on conservation efforts?
It's a disaster, the fact that people are no longer interested in Africa. It means it's very difficult to get any kind of reasonable budget for a program. I must say that Kenya has been, where I live, has been an exception to this rule. They've been lucky, I think, largely through the efforts of Richard Leakey. But in much of the elephant's range, funding for projects has completely died away.
Do you see the United States under the Clinton administration taking more of a leadership role in global conservation and environmental matters? Is the reluctance to sanction Norway for whaling a sign of shying away from an activist role?
I'm not an expert on American politics, I have to admit. I can only put to you the facts of what comes from the field and hope that it will engage the politicians' interest, because there's no question that the ultimate determinant of elephant ecology is political.
You know more about the EC? What type of leadership is the European community playing in environmental concerns? Are you satisfied?
The European community played an important role with a similar budget to the US Fish and Wildlife budget that I've described. And they've also, again, given a lot of lip service to the idea of environmental impact assessments on their projects in the field. But it still has to be sold to them that it's really important to give priority to projects which are going to support the remaining wild areas such as national parks and reserves in a big way.
How do you feel about the selling of elephant hides and meats as a result of culling in Zimbabwe and South Africa?
I feel that culling is a completely separate issue from the ivory trade. Nobody ever sold meats or hides as a poacher. They were produced from well-organized culling programs. And although I don't like culling aesthetically or ethically, I think it has to be considered for those countries that have judged it necessary. But it might be possible that a compromise could be struck if it was possible to separate trading in those products from trading in ivory.
How close are we to identifying through DNA the precise herd, or at least the region of the origin, in tracing tusks?
It's a good technique, and it probably can work. But the practical problem is that even if you can pinpoint the origin of elephants from a scrap of DNA scraped off a tusk, it's a very expensive process. It wouldn't be able to be applied on a large scale, and it still won't solve the problem of the corruption which has always surrounded the trade in ivory.
Speak, if you will, to the question of eco-colonialism versus involvement of indigenous people.
You know, it's a very strange idea that only white people are conservationists. It's not what I've found in Africa. I think the people who've spoken to this theme literally didn't go and talk to Africans, or they chose very carefully who they talked to. I certainly haven't found in Nairobi any lack of black conservationists. And I would say that conservation is not a colonial theme. It's a vital necessity for our future existence on this planet. In the Africa that I now see, there are many more young and bright Africans entering this field. It was a pretty new field when I started. I think there was only one wildlife biologist in the whole of Tanzania in 1961, but we were amongst the very first people there, and of course, in a newly independent country where human skills were desperately needed, The priority tended not to be on wildlife conservation. The brightest Africans went into the treasury, or they went into politics. I was going to say the brightest and the best, but I think some of the worst went into politics as well.
You said you no longer see dead elephants beyond the level expected by natural mortality. Is this not cause for us not to be concerned for your cause?
Well, I think the problems have changed. The places I go specifically, or have been since the ban, have been Kenya, Namibia, and South Africa, where I've conducted field surveys, and I found that the carcass ratios are way down there. Now, in Kenya, it's definitely a sign of a change in the intensity of the ivory poaching. But the new problems are really questions of space and conflict between elephants and people. The elephants, being very intelligent animals, as soon as they learnt that they were safe, started to venture back into their ancestral grounds, and having been away for quite a while, what did they find but people had, in many cases, planted rather attractive things for them to eat. So they've been doing this in Kenya, and we have a real problem of conflict between people and elephants, and we have ultimately this problem that if human populations don't stabilize, it won't be possible to keep any wildlife preserves.
Botswana's reputation concerning its wildlife has mostly been good. What is the current status of the elephant in Botswana? Getting better, getting worse, the same?
It's pretty much the same. They've got a very large elephant population. It's the last wholly intact elephant population on the African continent, the sort of population we used to have in the Selous Game Reserve. I think they're up at about the 60,000 number, although they census them by techniques that leave a margin of error on either side. And this population links up with elephants in Zimbabwe, ranges right across the Caprivi Strip into Angola. And so far, the elephant poaching, unlike the rhino poaching, has been very low.
Do you focus on the African elephant only, or worldwide, such as India? If only Africa, are there other organizations covering other areas of the world?
Yes, there are. I do focus only on African elephant. I've been recently to India. I was there this year and had the privilege of looking at one of the finest elephant training centers where they train by kindness without hitting the elephants. But there are other organizations, such as WWF, that have a scope that goes way beyond Africa. And the Asian elephant is actually more critically endangered than the African elephant, and it deserves a lot of attention.
And how about other endangered species? How much are you involved in other animals?
Not that much. I feel that the thing about an elephant is that to conserve elephants, you have to conserve enormous chunks of natural habitat. It's a kind of umbrella species, a keystone species, that if it's doing well, there must be a lot of other animals that are doing well around it. So when you get the message that it's the ecosystem and the habitat that has to be controlled, that naturally covers a great many other species at the same time.
How can individuals here have an impact on your crusade?
Well, I answer some of those questions in the speech. You can keep pressure up with your government at a political level on countries that do not observe CITES. You can encourage your government to fund vital conservation projects in Africa and vital family planning projects in Africa. And on that, I would say that although there was a lot of cultural resistance to family planning 10 years ago, attitudes are changing extremely fast in the parts of Africa that I know, and that now there are not enough family planning services available to meet the demand in the rural areas. Finally, of course, you can support organizations like the African Wildlife Foundation that are leaders in their field and have a very marked presence out there in the field.
What are the biggest gaps in supporting research now?
really surveys. It's very difficult to get money for elephant surveys to be able to continue monitoring and to keep a pulse, a finger on the pulse of what's happening to the elephants. And also, of course, it's difficult to get money for behavior research because that's not seen as a desperate matter of life or death, but is nevertheless, I think, very important to understand these creatures.
Could you comment on Richard Leakey's efforts to preserve a safe future for elephants in Kenya? How effective have his efforts been?
So far, it's one of the most effective things I've seen. I've looked for 25 years with horror at what has happened in the decline in standards of wildlife management in East Africa and in the Kenya Wildlife Department. We went through phases of underfunding, mismanagement, and corruption, which culminated in the destruction of Tsavo's elephants. But since Richard Leakey was given charge of that department, he's breathed a lot of new life into it. He's managed to secure major funding from the World Bank and bilateral donors. And the status of the department has changed from being a government-run department to being an independent parastatal. This allows them to solicit money independently, and he's more than doubled his independent revenues since the Kenya Wildlife Service became an independent parastatal.
What do you think about removing tusks to save elephants?
I don't think it'd work. The reason it wouldn't work is you can't properly remove them. If you sawed the tusk off close enough to the lip to make the ivory no longer attractive, you'd cut straight through the nerve that goes up through the ivory and it would cause the elephant a lot of pain. But it's not a solution. I've seen elephants killed for very small tusks. What is more of a solution is just to keep that demand down and keep that ivory trade shut.
You mentioned several other animals, but what about walruses? Are they being preserved by anyone, or does the foundation care about them?
Well, we don't get walruses in Africa, and it is the African Wildlife Foundation, but I'm sure that individual members care an awful lot. I certainly do. I sympathize with any animal that carries ivory.
Many people say the ivory ban has increased the price of ivory and spurred on more poaching. How do you answer that?
Did that also come from Ray Bonner's book? It's completely inaccurate. In fact, the ivory price has collapsed from around about $100 a kilo down to about $15 a kilo, depending on where you go. But in the field, which is the important place, the floor has been taken right out of the ivory price.
What can be done to stop the Taiwanese, other than maybe things you've mentioned?
I wish I knew. I don't know the Taiwanese very well. Public relations campaigns have worked very well indeed in the West, and the African Wildlife Foundation has a major public relations campaign going in Japan. I don't know if you've tackled Taiwan yet, but maybe in the end that is the route to go, to try to persuade people that their actions are going to destroy things that have value elsewhere.
You seem to share the philosophy of many environmental and conservation groups who make economic arguments for their causes. Is saying that Kenyans can financially benefit any different from saying that poaching allows Koreans or Kenyan collaborators to benefit financially? Why not just make the persuasive case on ethical grounds, or is that not good enough anymore?
I would love to make it on just ethical grounds, and I tried to bring that in. But one has to be realistic. People aren't going to survive on ethics alone to put bread into their stomachs. And if wildlife is going to survive, we have to find ways that it can benefit local peoples. I'm convinced of this. Therefore, it is terribly important that tourist revenues from wildlife should be shared with local people, and many more ways of doing this should be investigated and built up at a field level.
Could you give some perspective on the economy of Kenya? How important is $20 million from tourism to sea elephants for these countries?
It's very important. Tourism is one of the major revenue earners. I think it's the largest revenue earner of foreign exchange. And it could be a great deal more important. The elephants are a significant component of that.
However, as long as there is a financial incentive to sell ivory, how can you reasonably expect poachers to stop their practice?
Because the financial incentive is less now than it was before, and also because substantial funds have been put into the Kenya Wildlife Service, which is a sort of model, I think, for other countries. If other countries could be as successful as that, and if the money could be invested in straight protection and building up the national parks, it becomes possible to withstand this huge incentive of making money from ivory.
What are substitutes for ivory?
Certain types of wood can be used, and jade. I believe the Japanese now use far less ivory in their hankos than they did before, and they use either high quality woods that can be carved or stones.
Do you have any ivory?
No, I didn't. I gave my last ivory away many years ago. I gave it to a museum.
Have you teamed up with other international environmental groups to save the elephant? If not, why not?
Yes, I have. I mentioned some of them in the talk. Part of the excitement of this movement has been that there was an almost unified conservation movement in 1989 to push this ivory trade ban through. And where I am based in Nairobi, there are a number of little groups, Friends of Conservation, African Wildlife Foundation, World Wildlife Fund, the New York NYZS Conservation Society, and we all talk together and we all work together.
If there can be no wildlife preserves, if human population growth continues to skyrocket, and since population growth is unlikely to stop, are we merely buying time until the inevitable occurs?
And what is the inevitable? Our own demise, I suspect. No, we have to buy time. We have to do everything we can. And you can't plan too far ahead. You have to deal with the situation now. But I'm not so pessimistic that we're going to fail. I've seen changes in attitudes on family planning. I've seen new conservation activities built up. And I think we simply have to leave enough space for elephants so that we don't reach that inevitable point.
You've raised your children in the bush. Tell us, please, how they are doing and whether, is this such a marvelous environment for your children? Are they different, perhaps, than the children of people in this room?
Well, one of them is an anthropologist. She's just graduated from St. Andrews University in Scotland, and the other is studying politics down in Cape Town University. And they seem to have survived their upbringing, which I suppose is all a parent can ever ask for. It poses some difficulties being remote, and I think this happens to a lot of people. They actually have to come in from the bush in order to get near to a school, which is what happened to us when they reached an age that they had to go to school. But they do have, how can I speak with objectivity about my children? They do have a wonderful, free, open, and easy air, which I believe may have something to do with the space and the quality of life of East Africa where they've been brought up.
Would you support environmental enrichment programs for captive bred endangered species?
Environmental enrichment programs for captive born endangered species. May I speak to the elephant? I've been around a number of zoos since I've been here. I'm very saddened always to see that even the best zoos, there's not enough space for the elephants. And I think they would have an immensely richer life if they were allowed out to go and destroy some woodlands around the zoos.
But is there any time when this can be helpful for then reintroducing these animals into the wild?
It's a big problem taking an animal out of the wild, bringing it up in captivity. And the more complex the animal, probably the bigger the problem, because it may have some cultural transmission or memory of its environment that may be lost if it has to spend a few generations in the zoo. However, that said, it has been done successfully, as with the Arabian oryx, which Mark Stanley Price of African Wildlife Foundation played a key role. And in the case of the elephant, if it ever came to that, which it needn't, I think one could reintroduce them into the wild, just as Daphne Sheldrick has done with her orphans down in Tsavo.
A cultural question. How do you convince a society not even certain whether it wants to pay for the health care of less privileged human beings to care about faraway elephants?
Well, if America wants to be neo-isolationist and ignore the problems of the third world, they might one day find that the third world has come to their own doorstep. We can't just ignore millions and millions of people rapidly increasing in abject poverty, because they'll sure as hell move one day.
Does Money for Wildlife take funds from programs for people?
I don't think so. And the way they're usually structured, they're actually money for people going into wildlife. Take again the case of Kenya. It's absolutely a matter of economic survival that the wildlife parks should become and remain viable. If they didn't, the entire tourist industry would collapse, and with it an awful lot of people would be out of a job, and also people who sell their products to the tourist industry would also be suffering economically.
You gave us a wonderful description of elephants and how they are somewhat like people. What specifically about elephants attracted you to them?
Well, it's partly their size and the fact that here you have such a powerful animal that at the same time can be so delicate and so tender. A complex animal, they don't always respond in the same way. And I've given you a bit of the story of how gentle and delicate they are to each other, but it's not all love and tolerance all the time. Sometimes young calves, instead of being the center of attention, are treated as rather as a pest. And my own children once met the famous orphan of Tsavo called Eleanor, and they were treated with great tolerance by her, but after they'd been shrieking and patting her around her feet for 2 hours, with one majestic sweep of her leg, she knocked my younger daughter off her feet. But it was a measured blow that didn't do any harm. My wife took a picture.
How do you interest Americans in funding your programs?
By trying to interest them in elephants, by trying to persuade them to come out and see these things with their own eyes. Once you come to Africa, you're lucky to escape if you're unhooked.
You said elephants were exceptionally smart. Can you give us some examples?
Yes. When they have to negotiate new things in their territory, they probably find novel ways of doing it. And recently, when a fence was put across the range of the Laikipia elephants in northern Kenya, and a calf was stuck on the other side of the fence, an elephant leant over and picked it up with its tusk and took it across. And this has actually been photographed by Cynthia Moss and Amboseli.
Why is it, do you think, that we regale our children with animal tales such as Barber, only to neglect those stories as adults?
I suppose we lose touch with something that's really rather important in our lives. We get swept up into businesses and busyness and don't have time to reflect on the true values of nature. But it's out there, it's waiting there to be seen.
Now, before I ask the last question, I want to present to you a certificate of appreciation, just like Maggie Thatcher is going to get tomorrow, and a Press Club mug, just like she's going to get tomorrow. So you have that in common with her, too. And I'd like to say again that audio and videotapes of today's luncheon are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. All proceeds of the sale of tapes benefit the National Press Club Library. Now the last question. We now know that elephants communicate. What are they saying to one another?
Well, lots of things, probably about 25 different things. Joyce Poole is the scientist who's worked on this, along with Katie Payne and Willem Langbaugh. And if you actually to prove what they say is quite difficult, but I'll talk about the ones that really have been proved. One of them is when a young female has come into estrus and she's been mated by a young bull and she hasn't yet ovulated and she emits a low estrus rumble in the infrasonic component, which seems to say, I'm here and ready, come and get me. And sure enough, the bulls come thundering up. And when Katie Payne taped these calls and replayed them, she had alarming encounters of elephants that came thundering up to her car from far and wide.
Thank you very much.